You're on 10 on your guitar. Where can you go from there? Where?
I don't know.
Nowhere, exactly. What we do is if we need that extra push over the cliff, you know what we do?
Put it up to 11.
11, exactly. One louder.
Why don't you just make 10 louder and make 10 be the top number and make that a little louder?
These go to 11.
Welcome to Content Robots and Rock and Roll, the podcast where we talk about content marketing, creativity, technology, and AI, all in the context of some of the best rock and roll music. Now here's your host, Mark Donner.
I thought that for our 11th show, a very special number in rock and roll, we should celebrate the occasion by looking back and summarizing where we've been. So I've selected some of the moments from the first 10 episodes of the podcast. If you're interested in hearing more about any of the topics covered today, I'll have a link in the show notes to each episode I've pulled content from. But if you've ever watched a sitcom from the 80s or 90s, you might be familiar with the concept of a clip show. Producers didn't have the time or the budget to produce another episode to fulfill their order, so they just set the cast down in the living room and had them think about wonderful moments from the past, and then they'd fade into clips of old shows. Yeah, that's what I'm doing. You want a rock and roll comparison? Call it a greatest hits. I think it's a good way to repurpose existing content and bring your audience up to date on where you're at and where you've come from, even if they haven't listened from the beginning. And by the looks of my stats, I know that you all haven't listened from the beginning. So since this podcast is mostly me talking, I didn't want to cut into each clip with more of me talking and confuse you about whether you're listening to Mark in the present or Mark in the past. So to do that, I'd like to introduce you to Bella.
Hi, Mark.
Hey, yeah, sometimes I talk to my robot voices. Get over it. Now, you know, I use AI voices here and there, mostly from the Descript platform, which is where I record, edit, and produce this podcast. Today, I decided to try another AI-based voice system, appropriately titled 11 Labs. 11labs.io is the website. The tool's in beta right now, and you can tell, sometimes it just gives you an error. But the voices, particularly the stock voices, are quite good. Like the script, you can actually feed it your own voice or someone else's, but don't do that without explicit permission, please. And it will make a voice version of you that's fairly convincing. For today, we'll just be hearing from Bella, and she'll be introducing each section of the podcast. Take it away, Bella.
Okay, here it goes. Let's start by going back to the first episode and introducing someone who should need no introduction, David Bowie. Simplicity in storytelling is an important concept, and we used David Bowie's Ziggy Stardust as an example of how to create a simple yet powerful story.
1972's The Rise and Fall of Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars is one of the most influential rock albums of all time. Ziggy is a concept album that loosely follows a rock star from outer space who comes to save the Earth 5 years ahead of an impending disaster. Over that time, he becomes beloved, rises to epic stardom, except Ziggy buys into all of his hype, starts to self-destruct, eventually dying on stage, surrounded by fans. The concept album is told in a story form with a point of view that shifts throughout the album. Here's Bowie to talk a little bit about that.
I put three viewpoints into the album from three different areas. Maybe the character himself would appear, and then there would be two other statements by two other people, all on one album. I mean, it was the way an author would write a book. Yes. Rather, I mean, it hadn't been utilized that much in records. Here's it was the a theater piece that the spiders didn't really exist, that they only existed for the length, the duration of that character's life.
Right.
I was stuck with him for a long time. It took a long time to shake him off after I'd finished working with him, because people relate to him more than David Bowie at the time. Yeah. It was still very hard for anybody to realize that a rock artist can go on stage and be a different person every time he goes on stage. You don't have to be the same personality every time you go on stage. And mine was more exaggerated.
Despite all of that, the magic in The Rise and Fall of Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars is, as Bowie told us, in its simplicity. The character was designed to be a fairly common archetype, a messianic character of sorts. It's kind of a typical rock star story arc, with the exception being, of course, that the main character is an alien. Bowie used a few influences to bring that together, including the New York City band The Velvet Underground, as well as makeup from Kabuki Theater and elsewhere. That was it, though. It was a pretty simple concept. Everything else that Ziggy Stardust was to fans around the world came from what they brought to the character. in Harvard Business Publishing's white paper, Telling Stories, How Leaders Can Influence, Teach, and Inspire, the authors, Vanessa Boris and Lainey Peterson, tell us that, quote, storytelling works because it parallels the ways in which we receive, analyze, organize, and archive any information that comes into our brains. Facts enter as data points. Stories connect the dots. When we hear a new story, we value it and attach emotion to it. We integrate it with our own inner treasure trove of previously heard or directly experienced moments, adjusting, updating, and replacing old stories that are no longer relevant or accurate. Through new and updated stories, we absorb incoming facts, make connections, and interpret meaning, and changes to neural pathways actually happen. As a result, we're able to work from a larger story, one that offers greater perspective, enabling more options and more opportunities to try on new ideas or behaviors without external risk. And in that moment, sustainable learning occurs. End quote. Good storytelling lets your audience have just enough information to craft their own story based on the parameters you've set. In Ziggy Stardust, David Bowie got to that place through simplicity.
It's important to craft the story you tell so that it matches the channel where you distribute it. Who better to teach us about generating effective multi-channel content than Dire Straits?
Multi-channel content means what it says, simply distributing and promoting content via more than one channel. Channels might mean your blog, different social media accounts like Instagram, TikTok, YouTube, Facebook, even your podcast. Content repurposing then kind of means what it sounds like as well, taking existing content and making use of it in more than one way or on more than one channel. If you're following along, that would be how it connects to multi-channel content. So how do you take that story you want to tell and make sure that it resonates on the channels that you want to use? MTV was released on the 1st of August 1981 in the United States, eventually spreading throughout the world. Most early music videos were simple live performances or live in-studio videos, artist promos done by record labels, a lot of repurposed stuff. MTV kind of took what it could get initially, but something happened fairly quickly. Over a short period of time, the network started to move the needle for artists in a way that hadn't happened before. And a new crop of artists focused more on visual imagery and good looks and style started to appear. The bands of the 1970s who weren't interested, didn't play along with this new visual medium, or were simply a little too old or not attractive enough to make a good showing on MTV, they faded into the background. For artists who were right for it, who embraced it, and who started to make content with videos in mind, MTV became a significant driver for promotion, distribution, and record sales. Dire Straits was one such band. Dire Straits released videos throughout the years, but most really didn't get the attention that they could have. Then came 1985. MTV was like 3 or 4 years old at this point, and it had gotten a little stagnant by the time Dire Straits began work on their Brothers in Arms album. Some artists were still doing the bare minimum and releasing performance videos on a concert stage or in a studio. Some artists had gotten really creative, using film directors and actors, the latest visual effects, and even compelling storylines to create something entirely new out of their latest singles. A new industry had been built up around the new medium known as the music video. According to the 2012 book, I Want My MTV, The Uncensored Story of the Music Video by Rob Tannenbaum, Dire Straits management went to MTV asking point blank, what could we do to get on the network? Their response, essentially, it was to make a hit song with MTV in mind. An MTV-able song, as they put it. And of course, that would include a great music video. Easy, right? Well, not as easy in 1985 as it would be today. Despite his misgivings, Knopfler took that to heart in his own special way. He wasn't really a fan of music videos or MTV, but after nudging from his girlfriend and others, he wrote a cynical song told from the point of view of a couple of appliance movers that he'd overheard talking about MTV and how easy those rock stars' lives must be compared to theirs. The song featured their friend, Sting, who lent his voice to the beginning of the song, singing the words, I'm not going to sing them, just going to say them, I want my MTV. Literally an MTV-able song. The song, Money for Nothing, was a bit condescending towards the network, but they loved it. They loved having their name in it. Though it was condescending and sarcastic in a way that only Mark Knopfler could deliver, the phrase, "I want my MTV," was simple, memorable. Dire Straits produced a video using one of the great video directors of the 1980s, Steve Barron, and the video featured digitally animated characters. Those two aforementioned appliance movers, now shaped like TVs, with other TVs showing the MTV logo and playing other music videos. The video became a massive hit for Dire Straits and MTV. "I Want My MTV" became the slogan for the network for years to come. And that's kind of what multi-channel content is. How do we take our content and make it MTVable the way Dire Straits did for MTV, this new platform? Whatever MTVable means to you or your audience, that's what you should look for. Take it literally. Create content that literally addresses a need of your audience. Multi-channel content not only allows you to reach a wider audience or different audiences, as we just talked about, it increases the likelihood that your content gets seen by your intended audience. If done well, multi-channel content has the ability to become more than the sum of its parts. But it's more than just taking your content on one channel and putting it on another, as we've talked about. You've got to kind of re-engineer that content. Make it work natively for the new channel so that it can stand alone if it needs to. Where is your audience? Your persona should not only outline who your target audience member is, but where they're at online. What platforms do they frequently engage with? If you're looking to add a channel, that's probably where you should start.
A social media feud erupted in the world of rock and roll last fall regarding the use of laptops and digital tracks in live concert performances. Should digital technology be allowed at rock concerts? What can we take from this to apply to content marketing? That's what the episode, "Where Rock and Roll Meets Content AI," tried to figure out.
When I talk to content creators, writers and designers specifically, about the latest digital tech coming into the content world, and by that I mean artificial intelligence and machine learning, more often than not, I hear negative things or even dismissiveness. There's a reason for that. When AI for content first came on the scene a few years ago, the big belief was that writers would be out of a job in 5 years' time, and that brands could save money by eliminating human writers in favor of AI content generators. Though there are tools that purport to do that, the fact is that they alone are not ready to be put into use without a lot of human support and editing. Just like in a rock and roll show, the technology that we're talking about here can really be used to enhance what good writers and good content creators are already doing today, but it won't fully replace it, at least not right now. AI is not going to do all that heavy lifting. AI lacks that human understanding, human knowledge and context that's required for great storytelling. It doesn't have a sense of humor, for instance, not a good one anyway. It doesn't have real emotion. Perhaps the better comparison to draw between digital tools in rock and roll and digital content would be in the realm of marketing automation. Tools as simple as MailChimp to as complex and powerful as Marketo and HubSpot allow marketers to set up digital triggers and automation. Those tools help to nurture leads and take care of some of the time-consuming administrative tasks that go along with modern digital marketing. It enables marketers and creators to spend more time being creative, educational, engaging, informative, and less time stuck in an endless task list. In other words, what automation does for rock bands is what marketing automation does for digital marketers, and now is what AI can do for content creators.
Should you try and revive the dead? Probably not, but you can certainly revive undead content. In The Content Undead, we sought to do just that.
If you create content for any length of time, you're bound to have this problem. Over time, you forget about stuff. It drifts away, out of sight and out of mind, but nothing's really ever dead on the internet. Your old content is still indexed and still findable by people, by spam bots, and who knows what else. I recommend a quick content spot check. Do this. Use your Google Analytics or whatever system it is that you use to track performance on, whether it's a blog, social media, podcast, videos, whatever. Find those posts that are older than a year, 3 years old, 7 years old, whatever. You should be able to cross-reference those with your top content. What do you find? If your channel's anything like the one I used to work with, you probably have some really old content that's still generating traffic, but it may not be entirely relevant to what you're doing now. If your data shows that you're getting a ton of hits, but not a lot of engagement on your new stuff, that could be an issue. So what do we do about it? Well, you figure out what's attracting that traffic. In most cases, it's probably the title or metadata on the post, or an image or a keyword or a key phrase. You also want to look at where their traffic's coming from, because it could just be that the post is linked somewhere on the internet that gets traffic. Then you figure out what's legit and what's not. Once you've got that, you can go to work updating that post, tie it in with some newer content if it's relevant, or maybe it's something that's relevant to a current event happening in the world today, or something happening in your industry right now. I'm sure you can think of a lot of benefits. One, it helps with the health of your website overall. It minimizes your resource usage. It makes any search function you have more usable by visitors. It helps Google index your content. The main one, though, in my mind, is that it can save you time for recreating that same content over and over. You know you've done it before. Created almost the same post that you created a year ago. It happens. Why start fresh when you can update something that you've already got? Hunt down those big content monsters that might be lurking in the dark corners of your content channels and bring them back to the world of the living.
Next, in Humble Pie and Content AI, we took a look at one of the pioneers of the GPT-3 content creation world, Jasper. What can we take from this platform and other platforms like it?
It seemed to have gotten a lot better. Either that or I had learned to give it better inputs and achieve better results. No matter what it was, I started to find it useful. The copy I requested started coming back mostly right, with very little to change. The writing style got better, to where it basically sounded like a person, and a pretty smart person at that. Was it perfect? No. I found that the better I was up front with providing a good starting point, clarity in my points, the right keywords, and a point of view, all stuff that you can quickly feed into the system through their recipes, the better the output was. So I started doing it. Not for any client work or for pillar content that I was creating for myself. I did all that myself, as always. But for random things here and there that I just needed quick text for, I was pretty impressed. Now, I used to work in the business travel world, and I've got a library of old content that is no longer published either by my former employer or by me. There's no need for it. Much of it's out of date, but I've got it in a file that I just saved. So I decided to try rewriting one of those old blog posts. Just an experiment. Didn't have any use for it, but just thought I'd try it. I fed it the old info, paragraph by paragraph. The system's got a rewrite button. What happens when you press that button? It rewrites it. Pretty obvious, right? Sometimes it had to give me a couple options before it got it right. Or sometimes I'd take something from option one, combine it with option two to get the right paragraph together. But in about 15 minutes, I had rewritten and revised an obsolete 3-year-old blog post into something that was new. It was a good experiment. I talk a lot about repurposing, refreshing, and optimizing older, outdated content. Jasper could come in really handy if you had a stack of old blog posts that needed to be brought back to life really quickly. Are there some questions or drawbacks that I have about the platform? Of course. First of all, the question of where the platform actually gets all this information is one. The short answer to that is it comes from an open source AI system called the GPT-3 project, which is a system for AI text that mimics human language. GPT-3 took a large percentage of the internet and internalized that as its data source and did all of its fancy AI stuff to come up with a system that basically outputs text that sounds like a person. Then the Jasper system sits on top of that, and I don't know really how it works, but in my mind, it overlays these workflows and recipes and templates that help you to get the most out of what that text provides. Beyond that, I don't know. It's a little creepy how well it works sometimes. A few times I noticed that it would pull in proper names or product brand names, but they weren't real brand names. When I did a Google search on those names, it came back with nothing, meaning that it obviously took that from somewhere on the web, completely rewrote it from whatever its original form was. It was making up rewritten and alternate product and service names based on existing products and services. A little weird. And you have to be careful with the data the system pulls in. You've got to fact check everything before you publish. So that adds an extra step, but you're saving steps up front. So what's the application for this? Mostly, it's still for the simple stuff. Now, they purport to let you be able to write whole blogs. It kind of works. I've tried it. It's not perfect. Your social media captions and descriptions, your product descriptions, your metadata, sales page copy, website copy, short stuff, easy stuff to create. It can also be for more traditional content. So you think about feeding the tool an outline and having it fill in the gaps for you. And then you go in through and rewrite and edit the gaps. It actually can also help you create an outline, getting your main info and then going out and finding sections based on internet data and keywords. It can also help you with content topics. Like you can put in your general information and it will give you a list of content ideas, things you can write about. It's pretty cool. It's a good tool for brainstorming and coming up with ideas as you're putting your content calendar together. And there's still some manual brain power and creativity needed to give it your point of view and your writing style. But the system can do the grunt work. And I think about it like this, like a carpenter using a power drill or a farmer using a tractor. You still need that expert in the cab or operating the drill. Maybe one day you won't, but right now you still do. Same goes for this. Jasper and the other services like it. It's a content writing power tool. That's kind of the way I see it. In a matter of months, I went from a skeptic to not quite a believer, but someone who can see promise in the platform.
Were the Beatles good at managing content projects? What lessons can we learn from the greatest rock band of all time on how to make great content?
Building up a basis on how to create content, how to build creative content, how to build original content that sets you apart. Because let's be honest, if everybody is going to the well of ChatGPT and Jasper and DALL-E, which is all based on the same data set, which is the existing internet, you're never going to get anything new. How do we create new stuff? How do we create a framework for making that new stuff? How do we use AI to help us with that, not to do it for us? Content Project Management Lessons from the Beatles, Get Back. We're going to go right into the content project management takeaways. And there's a lot of things here that I think are pretty relevant. When you really think about it, it becomes clear that the Beatles were basically project managers. Their plan to perform their new music, live television of some sort, was the original plan, which would then become the basis of their upcoming album, resembled a content project in a lot of ways. I think about how I've worked with teams on formulating content. How do we want to do this? How do we want to formulate this? What's the end goal in mind? What do we want to get out of it? What are we doing it for? So many things like that. And then what form is it going to take? How do we picture it working in the final landscape? So because of that, I reached several conclusions that I think can help us all as we manage content projects. One thing that you'll find throughout the documentary is the band often seem to delve back into their roots. They'd noodle on an old blues or rock and roll tune. A few times they even revisited some of their earlier tunes to get in the right frame of mind to create something new. When you're taking a team approach to content, bring in an outsider to improve the creative process. I didn't really know about the extent to which Billy Preston was involved in the music that was created in this session. But sometimes it can help to have a friendly outsider to come in and contribute. Maybe they'll add something that works really well, or maybe they'll just see something you missed. He was in London, they invited him to the sessions, and they hired him. He had the musical skills to make them better. Not only did Preston add amazing keyboard parts, they tended to be on better behavior in his presence. They liked him, they respected him. They didn't want to appear in disarray while Billy was there. And he might have held the band together at that moment. They were on better behavior when he was there. So I guess the lesson from this is access every person and resource you have in order to do a better job at creating content. Improve your content by trying new things. So the Beatles were not afraid to try new stuff. From new musical instruments to state-of-the-art recording equipment, they seem to always be looking for something else to use, something new to try, some other sound or technique to bring new stuff to their recordings. For digital marketers and content creators, you may not be able to use a different musical instrument, but maybe you can use new marketing tools or employ new tactics to save time or eliminate bottlenecks. This is where the AI can come in. Maybe we can bring in those robots to help us bridge the gaps between the stuff we're not good at. Don't be afraid to try it. Don't be afraid to try new stuff. Sometimes when you try new stuff, really innovative things come out of that.
Jeff Beck was an innovative and inspirational musician, yet nobody could really copy him. Why was that? How can we learn from Beck and make our content inspirational but uncopyable?
That's what I'm looking for, is interest. Whether it goes over people's heads or not, I don't care, because they sit and listen. And even if they're not, if it's not, as long as it's not boring, you can sell people the stuff right there and then. It's interesting, and that's part of my thing is to try and draw in uniqueness of music choice.
Jeff Beck was a prolific artist whose career spanned decades. He released dozens of albums in many different genres, rock and roll, blues, jazz fusion being the most prominent. Beck had the unique ability to connect with audiences on an emotional level. He truly pushed the boundaries of what was possible in the world of music, particularly on guitar. If you play guitar, or at least pay attention to a lot of guitarists, you may have heard the phrase that their tone comes from their fingers. People will often use this statement about a select group of elite guitarists who can deliver a distinct and appealing tone regardless of what guitar they're using, or what effects and amplifier they're playing through, or have a sound that's so instantly recognizable that you know exactly who it is when you hear it. Names like Eddie Van Halen, Steve Vai, Brian May come to mind. Jeff Beck sits atop of that list. His technique and style of playing were so unique that it's hard to think of another guitarist that sounds like him. Nobody could really copy him. Of course, the legions of guitarists he influenced imitated what they could from him, and rightly so. But can you name a guitarist that people would call a Jeff Beck clone? I don't think so. I can't. Beck was, and still is, inspirational but uncopyable. So how do we be inspirational but uncopyable? In my mind, it's achieved through an intense and rigorous commitment to getting better. We don't have to be masters of the tools we use like Jeff Beck was, but we just need to keep working on it. Keep trying things to get better. Though unique and unconventional, Jeff Beck was fundamentally a sound guitarist. He worked hard at his craft and he evolved it over the years. Let's apply this in general to content creation. So anybody can throw a set of instructions into ChatGPT or DALL-E 2 and get something back that's reasonable. So how do we become the Jeff Beck of AI content generation? Well, I think you do it by knowing how to play it the right way. Instead of the guitar, I mean the robots, the AI technology that is on the market right now, helping us with content and helping us with marketing and helping us with writing and design. We got to learn how to play them. We need to learn what cues to give these robots to get their best results. We have to understand the fundamentals of this new technology to be able to play it in cool and innovative ways. What to put in order to get the best out of it. So how do we do that? Practice. Trial and error. It takes some work. It takes that knowledge and comfort that comes with knowing when to let the robots take the wheel and drive and when to operate it yourself.
Are you a created artist or a creative artist? Lionel Richie has something to say about that.
All the songs that I wrote and recorded were told to me by so many people, these are the songs that will destroy your career. What in the hell are you thinking about? For example, I had a group of people come to me and say, Lionel, this is funk. What are you doing with three times a lady, a waltz? What are you doing? And it went on to do great things. And then they said, can you give us another one of those three times a lady? And I gave them Sail On. And then they said, can you give us another one of those Sail-Ons? And that's when I realized the business, the true business was in the copying, not being original. So that's when I realized there are two types of artists, creative artists and created artists. And from that point, I decided I would be in the creative artist category. So when someone said to me, oh my God, I wouldn't do that song if I were you, that's the exact song I'm putting out.
Current Mark here again. Thanks, Robot Bella, for lending your voice to today's clip introductions.
You're welcome, Mark.
So that last clip from Lionel Richie's Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction speech from last year is what I wanted to close with, because I think that's the blueprint for what we want to do going forward with artificial intelligence. Well, that and the Jeff Beck lesson on how to be inspirational but uncopyable. AI is a tool. Companies, brands, even people looking for a shortcut or a cost saver on the internet will try to use AI for, frankly, more than it should be used for. as AI gets better. And in the next month, we're going to be looking at the latest tech from the GPT-4 project, which promises to be even more mind-blowing and human-like than GPT-3. Microsoft's set to incorporate GPT-4 into their Bing search engine, making Bing instantly relevant for the first time in its decade-long history. But people and brands won't be able to resist the temptation to exploit AI to its limits, no matter what those limits are. I truly believe that the only way we stay ahead of that is by using AI to support the creative process, to make things faster, to make things more efficient, but never to replace the creative process. Be like Jeff Beck. Be like Lionel Richie. Be like yourself. Inspirational, uncopyable, and creative.
This is an AI-generated voice telling you that if you have comments or questions about anything discussed on content, robots, and rock and roll, send us an email at podcast@superspacerobot.com. You can also visit the website at superspacerobot.com for more information on any of today's topics. Don't forget to subscribe to the show in your favorite podcast player so you don't miss an episode. Thanks for listening.